This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. A new book by our guest Catherine Boo takes us inside a shantytown on the edge of Mumbai, India's thriving financial capital. The residents of the slum, called Anawadi, experience a level of poverty hard for most Americans to imagine. There are about 335 huts, though some inhabitants lack any shelter and sleep outside. Rat bites are common among sleeping children, and barely a handful of the 3,000 residents have the security of full-time employment. A young trash picker named Sunil worries constantly that he will remain small because he doesn't get enough to eat every day. Anawadi is next to the Mumbai airport and surrounded by luxury hotels. Boo spent more than 3 years among residents of the slum, observing their social distinctions, their struggles to escape poverty, and conflicts that sometimes threw them into the clutches of shockingly corrupt government officials. Boo's book reads like a novel, but the characters are real. The New York Times book critic Janet Maslin said of Boo's storytelling gifts, "Comparisons to Dickens are not unwarranted." Catherine Boo is a staff writer at The New Yorker and a winner of the Pulitzer Prize and a MacArthur Genius Grant. This is her first book. It's called Behind the Beautiful Forevers. She spoke with Fresh Air contributor Dave Davies.
Well, Catherine Boo, welcome to Fresh Air. It's good to have you. Let's begin with a reading from the book. This is in the prologue. Early on, we are introduced to this character, Abdul. Tell us about him and set up this reading, if you will.
Okay. Abdul Hussein is 16 or maybe 18 or maybe 19. His parents are hopeless with dates. And for nearly his whole life, he's been supporting a family of 11, buying and selling the recyclable garbage that rich people throw away. And as the book begins, he's been accused of a terrible crime, which is the burning of a disabled woman. And the police are coming for him, and his parents tell him to hide, because if he's arrested, then the family will go hungry. And so that's where the book begins.
And he runs into the shed where he keeps his material, right?
He's in the Bollywood movies, the outlaw kid would be running off across the roof of a train, but Abdul's whole world is the slum of Anawadi, and the only place he knows to go to hide is in the shed where he keeps all his garbage. Inside was carbon black, frantic with rats, and yet relieving. His storeroom, 120 square feet, piled high to a leaky roof, with the things in this world Abdul knew how to handle. Empty water and whiskey bottles, mildewed newspaper, used tampon applicators, wadded aluminum foil, umbrellas stripped to the ribs by monsoon, broken shoelaces, yellowed Q-tips, snarled cassette tape, torn plastic casings that once held imitation Barbies. Somewhere in this darkness there was a Barbie or Barbly itself, maimed in one of the experiments to which children who had many toys seemed to subject those toys no longer favored. Abdul had become expert over the years at minimizing distraction. He placed all dolls in his trash pile, chest down. Avoid trouble. This was the operating principle of Abdul Hakim Hussein, an idea so fiercely held that it seemed imprinted on his physical form. He had deep-set eyes and sunken cheeks, a body work-hunched and wiry, the type that claimed less than its fair share of space when threading through people-choked slum lanes. Almost everything about Abdul was recessed, save the pop-out ears and the hair that curled upward, girlish, whenever he wiped his forehead of sweat. A modest, missable presence was a useful thing in Anawadi, the sumpy plug of slum in which he lived.
Thank you. That's Catherine Boo reading from her new book, Behind the Beautiful Forevers. So Abdul was a guy who grew up picking through trash. He had a particular dexterity for sorting through garbage, right?
He'd been doing it since he was six. His muscles had developed around the labor, and so he became able to take what people threw away and make not just a subsistence living for his family, but one of the best livings in the slum. And that caused some people to wish his family ill.
And that's because he graduated from just picking through trash, but actually buying it from others and then getting it to recyclers, right?
Right.
Now, so you were there for more than 3 years. How did
Yes.
people react at first to this blonde American woman in, you know, in the slum?
Oh, God. At first, I was a circus act. I was a freak. Everywhere I went, people would be like the Sheraton, the Hyatt, the Intercontinental, because this slum was surrounded by luxury hotels, 5 luxury hotels, and people thought I lost my way going from the airport to the Hyatt. But the people in the slums had concerns a lot more pressing than my presence. They had work to do. They had families to raise. They had hopes to fulfill. And so after a while, they kind of relaxed and let me just follow them as they lived their lives. And one of the things that I would do was I wasn't trying to gather people around a table and talk to them. I was just going where they went. I was doing what they did, whether it was teaching kindergarten or stealing scrap metal at the airport or sorting garbage. And I would just sit and listen and talk to them intermittently as they did their work, because it was very important to me not to get in the way of their ability to make a living. But I also really wanted to know them.
Let me ask you to describe Anawadi. I mean, this slum, when you walk in, what do you see? How are people living?
Well, I'll describe it this way. You come into the Mumbai International Airport. You make a turn, and you go past a lavish Hyatt and a beautiful hotel called the Grand Maratha. By the time you get to the Hyatt, which is about 3 minutes in your car, you've already gone past this place. There's a rocky road that goes into it, and you turn in, and the first thing you notice when you get into this landscape of hand-built, makeshift, crooked huts is one of the borders of the slum, or was when I came in 2008, was this vast lake of extremely noxious sewage and petrochemicals and things that the people modernizing the glamorous airport had dumped in the lake. And so it was almost beachfront property on this foul, malarial lake. And all around it, in this the single open space in the slum, were people cooking and bathing and fighting and flirting. And there were goats and water buffalo. There was a little brothel, and men would line up outside the little brothel. And there was a liquor still. And mainly, there were families and children who were trying their best to find a niche in the global market economy. Almost no one at Anawadi had permanent work. 6 people out of 3,000, last I checked, had permanent work.
The corruption that you describe is just breathtaking. I mean, yeah. Everything comes at a price. The water taps that the government puts in are taken control of by the local political party. They charge for usage. Everything in the justice system. I mean, some of our characters get accused of a crime. Everyone from the person who takes their statement to the people in jail wants a handout. And then even medicines in the hospital are ripped off, so that if you go to the hospital and you want medicines, you have to get them yourselves. You say in here that the effect of corruption I find most under-acknowledged is a contraction not of economic possibility but of our moral universe. What do you mean?
I mean, what I see all the time in children in any country is an enormous ethical imagination. I mean, I really think that from a young age, people have a sense of justice. And what happens in a society that is so corrupt that even to help a neighbor bleeding on the street is to risk your own livelihood and your own liberty because the police system is so corrupt? I think that innate capacity for moral action gets sabotaged, gets abraded. And I think that I see that constantly in my work. I see constantly that in corrupt societies, in extremely viciously competitive societies, people's instinct to do the right thing gets turned upside down.
India is, of course, a country with a longstanding caste system. And I wondered, as in a place like Anawadi, where you have people from many different regions engaged in all kinds of pursuits, surrounded by a country that's supposed to be modernizing, to what extent castes determined how people were perceived? To what extent could people transcend that structure?
Most of the people in Anawadi were low caste, SC or OBC, if people are familiar with those terms. But what's happened in the cities is that people are free to invent their own livelihoods in a way that they aren't in the village. So for instance, there was one Brahmin family. They had come from a rural community where the only work that the Brahmin, the head of the household, would have been allowed to do was religious work. But since nobody from this village was around, and there was somebody who needed a laborer to roll tar on the road today, he could go and do it and wouldn't be stigmatized in his community. Similarly, there are traditional castes who do rag picking and scrap picking, and but now so many people see that that's the only work they can get, that people of all manner of castes have come into that business and made it extremely competitive and difficult for those traditional people like the Matangs who have been collecting for generation upon generation. But one thing that was very clear to me is that the young people in a place like Annawadi aren't tripping on caste the way their parents are. They know their parents have these old views. But every day at the slum, it was more important, well, you know, can you hit a cricket pitch? Can you dance? What are your, you know, do you have a good job? I mean, those things among the young people were much more important in determining who got respect and who didn't than the caste that they'd been born by.
The poverty that you describe is, I mean, it is so grinding. So many people are on the very edges of existence. What are some of the ways that people escape? I mean, escape their misery.
Well, the drug of choice at Annawadi was something called Erasex, which is the Indian equivalent of whiteout. That you, when you mistype, you white it out, and people in the office buildings all around Annawadi would throw out the bottles when they were not quite empty, and the kids of Annawadi knew the value of the dregs. You'd just, you know, spit in the bottle and get it on a rag and sniff, and you got a high that was, for one, it was hunger killing for the people who didn't have enough to eat. It was a very effective alternative to food. But the other thing is, it just, you know, this work is day after day collecting garbage in a society that repudiates them for the socially necessary work that they do, keeping the streets of the prospering city clean. That really wears on your mind, and the kids were very much aware, and the adults, of the fact that the people who went in and out of the airports looked at them as if they were garbage too. And you know, a little Erasex after the workday could kind of take the edge off that.
One of the most remarkable things to read here was that you tell us in the book that no one in Annawadi was actually considered poor by official Indian benchmarks. Is that right? I mean, if they're not poor, who is poor?
Go to the village and you'll see what poor is. So officially, the poverty lines in many countries, including India, are set so low that officially the people that I'm writing about look like part of the great success narrative of modern global capitalism. They look like the more than 100 million people who've been freed since liberalization in India in 1991 from poverty. So usually in my work, I'm not looking to write about the poorest and object. I'm not looking to make you feel sorry for people. I want readers to have a connection more blooded and complex than pity or revulsion. But really, the main point that I have to say is that on the books, these men, women, children have succeeded in the global economy. They're the success stories. But I hope what my book shows is that it's a little more complicated than that.
Well, I mean, so many of them are just on the edge of losing, you know, food and shelter for the day. I mean, are the truly poor? Are they rural poor who sleep out in the open? I mean, who are the?
Well, many people in Annawadi sleep out in the open too. But when Asha, in the book, I follow Asha, the mother who has used politics and corruption to try to give her daughter a college education. I follow her back home to Vidarbha, a very poor agricultural region. And when Asha walks through the door, everybody can see on her face and the face of her children how good life is in the Mumbai slums. Asha's grandmother walks on all fours. She's so bent from agricultural labor. And when Asha walks in that door, she stands mast straight. So however you think however tough it is in the Mumbai slums. As Abdul Hussein says once, it's hard. The city is hard on migrants, and it's terrible sometimes, but it's also better than anywhere else.
And you write about suicides, particularly among women. How common was that?
In my work in general, I don't just immerse in a community and follow people over a long period of time. I also gather public records, official records from public hospitals, from police stations, from courts, morgues, public health offices, schools, education offices. And one of the things that I became very interested in when I was at Anawadi is how people died. Because I had a very strong sense that the official record of what happened to people wasn't accurate. And one of the things that I found was that there were women who were taking their own lives and just refusing the very limited options that they were afforded in terms of choosing who to marry, in terms of whether to have children or not. They were opting out. They were committing suicide. Part of what I talk about in the book is I tell the story of one girl whose arranged marriage was fixed at 15, who felt very strongly that there was another life, a more liberated life for women outside the slum, but she just didn't know how to get there. She would see these commercials and the actresses were lifting up an orange soda and saying, now have a little fun, have a little wildness. And she wanted that. And I think for many, many young women in the slums, it's just a question of, I know it's happening. I know it's happening right outside the walls of this slum. But how can I get there?
And rat poison was available.
Yeah, rat poison was available for 35 rupees.
As I consider how much time you spent among these folks, I have to believe that you must have felt a lot of affection and sympathy for so many of them. And, given the poverty that they suffered under, I could imagine that you must have at times felt compelled to help them. I mean, what you or I spend for lunch would have been a windfall to so many of these people. On the other hand, the need is so immense that you could get everything your own and there would be more of it. How did you deal with that feeling?
When I first came to Anawadi, I explained that I was there to write about them and that the constrictions of my profession, which I try to adhere to, involved that I didn't end up paying them for their stories. It's a convention in my profession that I struggle with. But at the same time, I know that if I'd gone to Anawadi and started handing out money to some people and not to others, first of all, it would have been a very disruptive thing. And also, my hope is that by following people and looking not just at often in journalism, stories about the poor began with a reporter going to an NGO and saying, tell me about the good work you're doing and let me follow you. And maybe if you could just pick out some real success stories, I'll write about them. I think that those kind of stories do an injustice to the enormous amount of creative and enterprising problem-solving that low-income people do for themselves, that most of the ways that people get out of poverty in the United States, in India, in anywhere else I've ever been, is through their own imaginations and their own fortitude. And I don't automatically presume that my way, there were certain moments that where I wanted to intervene and say, no, this is what I would do. But it's not necessarily the case that in their societies, my way would have been the best way. There are, as a journalist, for me, there are certain times when you absolutely stop being a journalist and you start being a human being. And there was one particular instance that I describe, a very, very brutal eviction where a gang of drunken men set upon a young mother. And there's a case where, no, you're not going to sit back and document this. You're going to do whatever you can to defuse the violence. I will say this, that I have a few friends who do this kind of immersion journalism, and it's extremely difficult sometimes to remember that you're there as a journalist and not a social worker. And I guess the only thing I can say is that what you end up seeing is you get a very close idea of what the needs really are, and then you come from that reporting and try to think in your own charitable giving, well, you know, what can I do to do the most good, not just for one person who I happen to be writing about, but for people that I've never met.
Well, Catherine Boo, thank you so much for speaking with us.
Thank you for having me, Dave.
Catherine Boo spoke with Fresh Air contributor Dave Davies. Her new book is called Behind the Beautiful Forevers. You can read an excerpt on our website, freshair.npr.org. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Chuck Prophet has referred to his new album, Temple Beautiful, as a love letter to San Francisco. Prophet has spent 30 years in San Francisco, with detours south to L.A., where he was a member of the band Green on Red and part of the city's psychedelic pop scene of the early 80s. Rock critic Ken Tucker says, you don't have to be a San Francisco native to enjoy Temple Beautiful.
Prophet's new album, Temple Beautiful, takes its name from a former synagogue that hosted punk rock shows in the late 70s and early 80s. It was next door to the temple overseen by the cult leader Jim Jones. That may sound like a grim or black-humored reference point around which to erect an album, but with Chuck Prophet, grimness and humor, fact and fiction, mingle freely. Before anything else, he's a guitar player with a melodically nasal voice whose phrasing favors the whimsical and the querulous.
Rebecca, she was here. Rebecca, now she's gone. Rebecca got a nasty streak 7 miles long.
Over the course of this album, Prophet takes you on a tour of San Francisco as he's lived and dreamed it, watching Castro Street Halloween parades, the famous local stripper Carol Doda, and the San Francisco Giants era Willie Mays. Prophet says his album is filled with quote-unquote Google-free facts and non-facts to suit the mythology he wants to create about the city he's so fond of.
I hear the church bells ring, Willie Mays is up in bed. Crowd go wild, all it did was touch his hair. Oh, and meanwhile, Carol Doda stood up and said, I won't be ignored. She showed him everything she had, then she showed him all a little more.
One of the ways Prophet achieves tension and release in his songs is by contrasting the content of the lyrics with the tone of the music. Take, for example, White Night, Big City, about the 1978 murder of San Francisco supervisor Harvey Milk and the riots that followed the trial of Milk's killer, Dan White. Prophet frames his version of that narrative with a song that has a jaunty melody, a refrain featuring doo-wop-style harmonies, and an open-hearted compassion. The result is music whose ironies aren't cheap ones.
Mm-hmm.
Ultimately, you can listen to Temple Beautiful for the superficial catchiness of its tunes, Prophet's slash guitar chords, his searching, keening vocals, and have a good time. And if you want to, you can listen more closely to what he's getting at on this album and experience it as one man's alternative history of three decades of West Coast culture and politics. All that, plus a few awfully good songs about having your heart broken.
Ken Tucker is editor-at-large for Entertainment Weekly. He reviewed Chuck Prophet's new album called Temple Beautiful.
When the shots rang out and two men died, you took off your mask just to see me cry.
Coming up, former poet laureate Donald Hall reflects on how his life has changed in his 80s. This is Fresh Air. We've been following the life and work of poet Donald Hall over the years. He's a former poet laureate and professor. He had cancer when he was in his 60s. After he went into remission, his wife, the poet Jane Kenyon, was diagnosed with leukemia. She died in 1995. I recently read an essay Donald Hall wrote in The New Yorker about his life at the age of 83. He says he teeters when he walks and he can no longer drive. He spends a lot of time looking out the window in his New Hampshire house, which has been in his family for several generations. After reading the essay, which is called Out the Window, I wanted to talk with Hall again. Since it's hard for him to get out of the house, especially in winter, we just called him up. Donald Hall, welcome back to Fresh Air. I love your article in The New Yorker, and it just made me think about all the really, there's one section in it that made me think about all the real annoying ways that people who are old or who are young or who are short, like me, are patronized in ways that the people who are patronizing you don't, they think they're being nice, like they think they're flattering you, and they're so not. And I think you have the ultimate story in that category. Just to set it up a little bit, you were in Washington to receive the National Medal of Arts, an incredibly prestigious award. And you came early so that you could go to a couple of museums. So you're in a museum, and you're in a wheelchair because you can't be on your feet for long. And your friend is wheeling you around. And you see a Henry Moore sculpture, and you knew Henry Moore. You'd written a New Yorker article about him. You'd written a book about him. And, okay, so then what happens?
Okay, we were going around the museum a day or two before the medal ceremony. I can't stand up very long. So a friend of mine pushes me around, and we look at pictures together. At one point, we're standing looking at a Henry Moore sculpture or carving, and a museum guard who's standing nearby very kindly came over and told us that this was Henry Moore and that there were other Henry Moores around the museum. I had actually written a New Yorker profile about Henry Moore, later a book, and I knew Henry Moore very well. I thought for a second of telling this to the guard, but then it's too egotistical, and it might embarrass the guy. So I didn't say anything. We went on and looked at many pictures, and later that morning, we stopped to have lunch at the cafeteria. When we came out from lunch, me in the wheelchair and my friend Linda pushing me, the same man, the same guard, said to Linda, "Did you have a nice lunch?" And she answered him. And then he leaned down, smiled a hideous smile, shook his finger, and said, "Did we have a nice din-din?"
That's so horrible. I mean, like, you knew Henry Moore. You knew the artist you were looking at. you are a man of words. I mean, you are a poet. You are still writing. You were receiving the National Medal of Arts, and he asks you if you enjoyed your din-din, as if like you were 2 years old or something.
He talked baby talk at me, and we were just so flabbergasted. We didn't say anything back to him.
Did you want to? Did part of you want to say, like, cut it out, would you?
I didn't know what to say. I would could have called him an idiot or something, but I was taken aback, totally taken aback. And I was amused. I thought it was funny that he should make such a mistake. I wouldn't talk baby talk like that to a baby. Here he was talking it to an 83-year-old.
Well, part of what you write about in your New Yorker article is what the experience of getting older is like for you now at 83. What are some of the things that's surprising you most about getting older and about having trouble keeping your balance and needing a wheelchair when you're out, you know, having trouble with your fingers buttoning your buttons?
Yes, all that is natural, and it's a little depressing and progressive. Just recently, my knees have started buckling, and I have a brace on one of them. It's a steady kind of deterioration. The crazy thing is that I feel cheerful through all of it, and I don't mean that everyone does, but I do. For 4.5 years now, I've hardly have a sad thought except to curse a bit at my own clumsiness now.
And you are a man who is not unfamiliar with depression, am I right?
My late wife, Jane Kenyon, had it, and when she died, she was young, she was 47 when she died, I went through anguish, I yelled and I screamed, and then I had depression for a while. But I was able to write, and that really saved my life, and perhaps that's what's saving my life right now. I am physically handicapped, but I can sit in my chair and work at my writing, and I enjoy it. I have to do draft after draft after draft. I've always done that. I'm doing it more with prose than I used to get the words just right, you know. It takes me a long time. Well, I love doing it, and I have to do it every day, or I feel I'm not doing my job.
Well, let me ask you to read a short passage from your recent New Yorker article, Out the Window.
Yes. After a life of loving the old, by natural law, I turned old myself. Decades followed each other. 30 was terrifying. 40 I never noticed because I was drunk. 50 was the best. It was a total change of life. 60 extended the bliss of 50. And then came my cancers, Jane's death, and over the years, I traveled to another universe. However alert we are, however much we think we know what will happen, antiquity remains an unknown, unanticipated galaxy.
What is most unanticipated to you about this, quote, galaxy of being old?
Well, it probably is the attitudes of others toward age. And I don't mean to feel superior, probably, or to sound superior, probably when I was a young man, like 60, I looked at 83-year-olds as if they came from another galaxy. Now I find myself being seen that way. Sometimes I sort of don't exist. People don't see me. I know when I would have been like that, but it is weird to be in that position.
So, now you said before that your attitude has been really cheerful in spite of, like, diminishing physical abilities. And, you know, like, one way of dealing with diminishing physical abilities or illness is to get, like, really angry with your body. And apparently you don't feel that way.
Not really. No. I lament its disappearances, but I can't feel angry about it. It's natural. I am probably older at 83 than some people are at 90, physically older. But as long as I can do my work and continue to enjoy myself working on words, I feel fulfilled. Let my body cause me trouble when I cross the room, but I'm sitting down writing and I am in my heaven, my old heaven. I began writing when I was 12. I don't mean very well, but I've been doing it my whole life, and it's the kind of center of my life, together with loves and children. And writing is something I have that not everyone has, that I adore.
Now, you mentioned in this article that you're not writing poetry anymore. You're writing prose. Why is that?
I felt poetry slipping away, and I'm not sure why. It was palpable. And I've always thought that poetry was particularly erotic, more than prose was.
Do you mean like erotic in subject matter or sensual in terms of the language itself?
In terms of the language itself.
Okay.
I say that you read poems not with your eyes and not with your ears, but with your mouth. You taste it. This part of poetry, which is essential to me, seems to have diminished gradually until finally I really don't have it. I don't have so much particular inspiration either. It used to be that phrases, lines would come into my head, often many of them in a period of 5 days or a week, and maybe I didn't know what I was talking about, but the words had a kind of heaviness and deliciousness to them. That's decreased, become less frequent, until finally for the last few years, there's been none of that.
So what do you think about the idea of your books outliving you? Does that give you comfort?
Well, if it gave me, I can't say it does. I have hope, but I do not have anything like conviction or knowledge that they will. I have been alive too long among too many writers whose names I have seen so important, who have died and are not speaking of afterwards. Having some success in your life does not mean that your work will endure. In an almanac, look at the list of the winners of the Pulitzer Prize over the last 60, 70 years, and see how many names you remember. It's chilling, really. So I can hope, I can daydream, but I certainly think that the chances of me being read 100 years from now, 50 years from now, are probably not good. But that cannot be your only end. You cannot write in order to be, as it were, immortal, because you will never know. It's impossible.
That's true, isn't it? Yeah, you'll never know.
Forget about it.
Yeah.
Just write as well as you can, and don't speculate about whether you will be Chaucer or Shakespeare.
Donald Hall, thank you so much for talking with us again.
Well, thank you. It's very good to talk with you again after many years.
Yes, it's been a long time. It's good to catch up. So thank you, and I'll look forward to more of your writing.
I hope so.
Okay.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Donald Hall's essay, Out the Window, was published last month in The New Yorker. Coming up, TV critic David Bianculli reviews two new DVDs of TV shows that showcase comic writers. This is Fresh Air. When it comes to the home video release of TV shows, most of the attention goes to the newest seasons of the newest shows. But our TV critic, David Bianculli, says there's gold to be found in the first-time DVD releases of a couple of older TV programs. One is a 1970 edition of The David Susskind Show, and the other is an onstage reunion in 1996 of Sid Caesar and his legendary writers.
The two DVDs I want to talk about today are hilarious. But they aren't sitcoms. They're talk shows. Well, one's a talk show, and one's a film seminar. But they're both fascinating examples of a specific pop culture moment frozen in time. And there's something else as well. Both of them are highly entertaining real-time examples of talk show Darwinism. Both shows feature a large, unwieldy guest roster, all of the guests competing for attention at the same time. And by the time the programs are over, the winners are apparent. The first DVD, from Samore Entertainment, is a 1970 installment of The David Susskind Show, a syndicated talk show. The topic of this particular program, never before released on home video, was How to Be a Jewish Son. And the guests fielding questions from Susskind included actor George Segal, who had just come out with the movie Where's Papa, writer Dan Greenberg, author of the then-recent bestseller How to Be a Jewish Mother, and Jewish entrepreneurs from the fashion and fast food industries. But the breakaway stars, the guests who ended up running away with the show and taking it over almost completely, were David Steinberg and Mel Brooks. Steinberg had just played an unintentional part in the firing of the Smothers Brothers on CBS, and Mel Brooks had mounted the original movie version of The Producers. No matter the topic, these two were hot. And even when one of them was asked a question by Susskind, the other was just as likely to respond. And the responses, for the time, are almost shockingly candid. Here's Steinberg, the son of a rabbi and at the time very much a single young man, answering one of the host's questions about dating outside his faith. But when Susskind asks Steinberg a follow-up question, the reply comes from Mel Brooks instead.
Well, it's hard to bring a Gentile girl home to a Jewish family. What you do is you bring home a black girl first.
A way of breaking the ice.
Then you bring home the Gentile girl. Yeah. And then you're, they say, oh, come on in. It's a nice thing. Would you like something to eat? They say, Mary Smith, sit down. See, that's chul, like in Hanukkah.
Seriously, have you brought Gentile ladies into your household?
No,
Your father is being a rabbi.
Do you know in a Jewish religion, if you're going with a Jewish girl, if you're just engaged to her and you break off, you still pay alimony? You know that?
I didn't know.
Legal.
That.
That's legal.
That's legal.
Sure, three kisses and, and alimony. Alimony. It's not a lot. There is a token, like 80% of you.
In your bachelorhood, you must have paid a lot of alimony.
Oh, in my bachelorhood did I pay alimony. There was a girl in Scranton, I gotta tell you.
The David Susskind Show was televised for 28 years, and How to Be a Jewish Son was its most famous and most requested installment. And now it's here. The other DVD is a reunion of the writers who had worked with Sid Caesar, either on 1949's Admiral Broadway Review or his two 1950s TV classics, Your Show of Shows and Caesar's Hour. There are no clips from those shows on this DVD. What there is, though, is priceless. Unlike an edited version shown years ago on public TV, this is the entire two-hour seminar in which 10 very smart men sit on stage in folded chairs and tell their stories while telling jokes at the same time. What a panel. Lucille Callan, who wrote for Your Show of Shows, isn't there. Neither is Woody Allen, who wrote for some of Caesar's TV specials. But my, look who is. Not only Sid Caesar and his writing co-star Carl Reiner, but writers Neil Simon and his brother Danny, Larry Gelbart, good old Mel Brooks again, and others whose names are less familiar but whose one-liners here are just as funny. And that's what I love most about this freewheeling two-hour discussion. It's comedy at its most democratic, just as in a real TV writer's room. It doesn't matter who offers up the best joke. Funny wins. And all the others are smart enough to know funny when they hear it and laugh generously when it arrives. Here's a perfect example. Sid Caesar is describing the weekly budget for Your Show of Shows when one of the less famous veteran writers, Sheldon Keller, throws in an ad-lib that delights everyone, including Caesar.
The first Show of Shows cost an hour and a half, everything, all the writers, all the everything cost $64,000 a week for the entire show.
I saw the same show in Kmart for $28,000.
And right after that, someone else scores too. It's Mel Brooks, who clearly thrives in these highly competitive, joke-filled environments.
I belong to Sid. I didn't belong to the show. I didn't belong to Max Liebman.
That's right.
I belong to Sid.
You still do, don't you?
Yeah, and Sid. And Sid could call me night or day, and sometimes he'd wake me at 3:30 in the morning and say, Mel, Sid, need a joke. Okay. What is it? Carrots, okay, carrots. I ate so many carrots I couldn't sleep. He said, why not? I could see through my eyelids. Carrot. Oh, carrot. Joke.
That's the beauty and the equality of comedy. No matter who comes up with the joke, funny is funny. And so are How to Be a Jewish Son and Caesar's Writers.
David Bianculli is founder and editor of the website TV Worth Watching. He reviewed two new DVDs, Caesar's Writers, which was recorded in 1996 by the Writers Guild West, and How to Be a Jewish Son, a 1970 episode of The David Susskind Show. You can download podcasts of our show on our website, freshair.npr.org. And you can find us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at NPR Fresh Air. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Audrey Bentham. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Our associate producer for online media is Melody Kramer. Roberta Shurrock directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.